Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Helping you wake up, remembering this is our Father's world. This is Mornings with Carmen LaBurge on Faith Radio. If we're gonna fly, we fly like eagles. Arms out wide. If we're gonna fear, we fear no evil. We will rise. By your power, we will go. By your spirit, we are born. If we're gonna stand, we stand as giants. If we're gonna walk, we walk as lions.
Well, good morning, my friends. The United States sent astronauts into space over the weekend. You might have missed that. On Saturday, SpaceX, a rocket company that's actually founded by Elon Musk, we talked about him in relationship to the name of his most recent child that is a fairly nonsensical name. We talked about that last week. This week, were other things not ablaze across the country, we would be talking about the fact that the United States sent astronauts into space this weekend on the Falcon 9 rocket. The Crew Dragon capsule carried two NASA astronauts, and SpaceX is now the first private business to accomplish this particular feat, taking people into orbit. Prior to this, this is something only done by nations or nation states, and so that is notable. Later in the same day, the spacecraft docked at the International Space Station, successfully completing the first leg of its journey. And you might think of this as a test flight to sort of prove out that not only can a private company achieve what only governments used to be able to do, but that NASA might allow SpaceX to begin routine trips, not just taking astronauts to and from the space station, but, as Elon Musk's Musk hopes, space tourism might begin in the years to come. There you go. Now, you might have missed that over the weekend because, well, frankly, and rightly so, there's been wall-to-wall coverage this weekend of the protests initially related to, I still think this is all related to the death of George Floyd. However, peaceful protest turned violent, and then in some places they turned deadly. And so where a demand for justice in the case of George Floyd is righteous, and we have talked about that, and we will continue to talk about that, and we will continue to talk about not only justice for all, but liberty for all. Like, we have to get to a place in the United States of America where we're having real conversations about this, and we're not just shaking our heads and telling some people to get over it and other people continuing to be astonished by that which should no longer astonish us. You and I have both heard, I'm going to use this term really loosely today, leaders say things like, this is not who we are. Okay, I think it's time for us to sort of embrace the reality. This is actually who we are. We are where we are because this is who we have been for 400 years as a country. And so, and you say, well, we're not actually 400 years old. No, but now you are, once you start bringing those kinds of arguments into play, let me just say, you've already lost the argument, the conversation. This is a 400-year problem, and it's actually a problem that's a whole lot deeper and longer ago than that, because this is a sin problem, and this is a systemic sin problem. So there were, in many places, peaceful George Floyd protests. There were prayer gatherings. There were places where you saw young black people embracing white police officers. There are places where you saw armies of volunteers. Maybe you were one of them cleaning up. Certainly that took place in Minneapolis over the weekend. The Chattanooga police chief told officers that it was who felt like it was okay, like the George Floyd thing was okay, that they could just go ahead and turn in their badges because they were done. And there were places where, you know, police officers, a sheriff in particular, you know, said, I'm listening. What do you want us to do? And they said, walk with us. And he did. Laid down his helmet, laid down his baton, and walked with the protesters, advocating for justice and righteousness. That's what we need. And that's the direction that we need to be heading. And we cannot say today, oh, you know, things feel better. I feel a little better today because there is at least some restoration. I get that. But we are a long way from peace. We are a long way from peace. And so we're going to continue to talk about this in the days and weeks to come. But we have another issue, and that is COVID-19, the coronavirus. It's not gone. It hasn't gone away. And I am going to talk with Zach Jenkins next from Cedarville University about the second wave of the coronavirus, which I think we can now really all expect in about 14 days. Because if you've been seeing the pictures that I've been seeing, social distancing thing became a thing of the past over the weekend. So that's up next here on Mornings with Carmen. Joining me again today, Zach Jenkins, pharmacy associate professor of pharmacy practice at Cedarville University. He is an expert in infectious disease, which probably means that you're a person we don't really like want to personally hang out with. That seems kind of weird, right? Hey, Zach, welcome back.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, so I'm well. I wanted to ask you about monkeys stealing virus samples. I wanted to talk with you about all kinds of crazy headlines. But I think we should get focused pretty quickly here on the conversation related to a second peak. It's going to be more than a second wave, it sounds like. Maybe a second peak. And so just talk with us about your expectations and maybe the conversations that, you know, are being had among people other than, you know, the hoi polloi out here.
Well, I think we've been talking about a second peak and the possibility of that for a little while now. I think, if anything, the protests over the weekend, as a side effect, have kind of unintentionally spurred that forward, or that's at least a possibility. Based on some of the images I was seeing, obviously there are a lot of people running around without masks in really close proximity with one another, and large gatherings.
And,
so
yeah, yelling and profusely sweating. Maybe sweat's not
right.
A deal. Like, see, this would be one of those things where it's like, I don't know enough to know whether or not that's a thing, but the shouting really closely into one another's faces seems like a thing.
Yeah, and that's certainly the case. So they've actually shown that typically the virus doesn't aerosolize unless you actually speak with a large volume behind your voice. And so especially if you're doing that over a long period of time, that's when you can definitely create some particles that can float around in the air for a much longer period. So that's at least a concern moving forward. But the actual fear is that if we do actually have a second peak, it actually impacts some that have not been impacted. That's kind of the outline concern. Outside of the U.S., what we're actually seeing down in Brazil is about half of the cases, a little bit more than half of all the cases that they've looked at so far, are actually positive for COVID. And they have, they're right now number two in the world for a total number of COVID cases. They just shot up out of nowhere. So I'm concerned in the U.S. And certainly in other parts of the world where people are less, let's say, in more rural areas or maybe in third world countries that may not have the resources to handle some of these issues. And so that's kind of what we're starting to see.
So I'm looking at headlines related to Latin America, suggesting that the world's new COVID-19 epicenter could be the worst yet. Talk a little bit about what you're expecting in terms of Latin America.
Well, as of this morning, there are over 500,000 cases that have been identified in Latin America. In the U.S. right now, we're hovering at about 1.8 million. But Latin America has just shot up out of nowhere. And so what that tells us is that in some of these areas where people haven't necessarily had some of these lockdown restrictions, social distancing efforts, et cetera, they seem to be somewhat more impacted, especially in these areas that are considered more of a third world. Mm-hmm. So again, I think my concern there is as these cases start to grow, they may not be able to have the same effect at dealing with them due to a lack of resources in some cases.
Right. And I think about the situation in communities in Latin America where I have visited, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, even access to something as simple as washing your hands, certainly on a regular basis, but certainly no access whatsoever to the kind of cleaning products or the kind of preventative measures. I mean, we have talked here about being sure that people have the PPE that they need. They're certainly not going to have that in those kinds of locations. All right, Zach, when we come back from a very brief break, let's talk about vaccine and treatment research, what we think we know, and where you think things are headed. We'll be right back talking with Dr. Zach Jenkins. If you can know that. All right, continuing my conversation with Dr. Zach Jenkins from Cedarville University about what's going on with the pandemic, even in the midst of the pandemonium here in our own country. Zach, talk with us about treatment research and maybe progress we're making. I don't know, I'm going to use the word progress. We're making related to vaccines.
So as far as treatment options go, Russia actually just released a statement indicating that a Japanese drug called favipavir, if I'm pronouncing that one right. So it's another antiviral, but they just announced a statement that essentially it's proven to be effective against COVID-19. And so they're starting to roll it out across Russia in hospitals. So in their eyes, looking at remdesivir and looking at this new drug, favipavir, they think that those are at least two options that we have to treat the coronavirus. We don't really have a lot of data about that so far, but what we do know is at least it's another thing we can kind of compare against remdesivir, which is the only agent that's really been shown with some of the evidence so far to have an impact. As far as remdesivir goes, the company basically donated, Gilead donated all of its stock to the government to distribute. And so they've been sharing that around the country. So my hospital system, for example, we received a number of doses of it. My concern there is it's a kind of an awful place to be in because you have to figure out which patients need it, which ones don't need it with such a limited supply. So they're trying to ramp up production of that. We're trying to get that in place as quickly as we can.
It also sounds like Australia. I mean, you know me, I'm just like scanning headlines, right? It sounds like Australia is testing something based on a flu shot. So that's kind of interesting. Russia says they've got something that's working, which you referred to. And then Moderna, their vaccine trial has entered a second phase. Can you distinguish a little bit for us between when we see like phase one or phase two trials, what we're talking about?
So with the vaccines right now, they've all really been going through phase one, with the exception of the one that's just entered into phase two. But phase one trials are kind of geared at safety. That's their primary focus. They want to make sure that no major harm would occur with anyone receiving whatever medication we're looking at. And they also are sort of a dose finding study where they're trying to figure out what doses are safe or possibly effective. But the next phase, phase two, is where we start to actually look at outcomes. So does the drug do what we hope it says it's going to do? And that's done with a small group of people. And then when we enter into what's called a phase three trial, that's actually where we're looking at larger groups of people. And throughout this whole process, safety is constantly being tracked because if it's not picked up in a small group, maybe it's going to be picked up in a large group that there are these safety issues.
All right. And then we're also hearing that COVID-19 may be as much a vascular disease as a respiratory one. We talked a few weeks ago about, you know, strokes being something that very young people were dealing with in relationship to this. What do you know about this?
You know, that's a great question. And I've been watching this one with a lot of interest for some time now. So there's a thought that through a lot of mechanisms, the virus ends up causing inflammation of blood vessels, and that inflammation can cause damage, which can lead to blood clots, or it could potentially lead to symptoms like we're seeing in children, where they have the inflammatory conditions that kind of look like Kawasaki's disease. So that all kind of seems to be linked. And one of the big questions that we're asking from the patient management side It's really, do we use blood thinners in these patients? And if so, do we use a treatment dose, or do we just use kind of a lower dose to prophylax against these problems? And so that's one of the big debates that we're having, at least from the hospital side of things with patients, because we've seen a lot of these blood clots occur.
That is fascinating. Okay, so this is why I just love talking with you. Okay, how do we, or how might we lower our COVID risk?
As individuals?
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm not going and taking my family to eat out at restaurants, but I do go to the grocery store myself, or I go shopping. And as these places begin to open up, let me just tell you, my experience has been really widely varied. There are some places where, you know, they're actually checking your temperature when you walk in, and you have to sign a release and wear a mask. And there's other places where no one is wearing a mask at all, and people are packed in what I would, you know, consider a pretty dense situation. Talk with us about how we can protect ourselves individually from COVID risks as places reopen.
So I think that the three most important things that kind of come to mind, number one is washing your hands. That is consistently the most important thing with preventing any kind of spread of disease. And so I'd certainly say that here. So when you can, wash your hands. And if you haven't washed your hands and you're out in public at a grocery store, at a restaurant, don't touch your face until you wash your hands. So as much as you can do that, that's a good thing. The other thing I'd add to that is if you can't maintain good spacing with other people, that's, I think, where there's absolutely going to be a benefit to masks. Outside of that, try to maintain space where you can. I know sometimes that's difficult with these grocery store lines and things like that, but where you can space out, do it. If you can't use a mask, if you can use a mask and space out, it's all the better. But everyone has a different perspective on masks at this point. And some people, honestly, because of health conditions, can't always wear them.
And there's so much, I don't know what to describe this as, social pressure in one direction or the other, completely dependent on the environment you're in. I am not a person who I would have said prior to this, oh, I am totally subject to the way a group of people is eyeing me in relationship to whether or not I'm wearing a mask. I'm going to tell you, I am susceptible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're seeing a lot of mask shaming going on.
Yes, and mask shaming. That's what. People that are like, you know, looking at me like, I said, this has been my line. My 82-year-old mom had a heart attack last Monday. My listeners already know this. She had open heart surgery, a triple bypass on Wednesday. I want to be able to see her. I can't yet, obviously. But I want to be able, when they tell me I can see her, I want to be able to see her. And I want to be able to, you know, to say I have done absolutely everything in my power to protect myself and therefore my sweet mom from any kind of exposure. And so suddenly then people are like, oh, it's like you have to have as your excuse that you know a person who's at really high risk.
Yeah, I think, you know, as Christians, as polarizing as the subject tends to be, there have been enough studies that have shown that there is a benefit to wearing masks to preventing you infecting other people. And so in some of these cases, we have to remember that it's not really about us. It's just about caring well for others. And that's something that we have been called to do as Christians.
Amen. Hey, we love talking with you. Thank you so much. You know, we're not out of the woods yet, right?
Absolutely.
We're continuing to pray for you and other frontline medical workers in the midst of all of this. Dr. Zach Jenkins, thank you so much again for joining us today on Mornings with Carmen.
All right. You have a great day.
Have a blessed week. We'll be right back. All right. So we are just a couple of weeks. Actually, today's the June 1st. So we are 1 month from the day. To concluding our fiscal year here at Faith Radio. And I got to tell you, I know that you and others are relying on this ministry for encouragement, for the truth to be brought to bear on the issues of the day. I know that this is where you turn for good gospel preaching and teaching. And so we need you to come alongside us and become a part of the support network. We are really close to being fully funded in this fiscal year. And so if you are in a position to help us here at the year end. I'm going to invite you to do that. The easiest way is to log on to myfaithradio.com and hit the Donate Now button. If you are listening right now on the Faith Radio app, there is a secure way to donate there as well. You could text the word GIVE to 877-933-2484, or you can always give online at myfaithradio.com. Thanks in advance.
Is your child getting close to his 13th birthday? Mom, Dad, get ready for a major shift in parenting. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. For the first 12 years of your child's life, you teach them. Then it's time to train them. For 12 years, you give them lectures. Then you have conversations. For the first 12 years, you convey information. Then you impart wisdom. As your child becomes a teenager, his needs will change. He'll need training, not teaching, conversations, not lectures. Will you adjust your parenting style to meet the demands of each new season? Or hope that the same old tricks will still work? Updating your parenting habits may be uncomfortable and even a little painful at times, but make this birthday a turning point for you and your teen.
Want more help from Mark Gregston? Find books and other resources online at ParentingTodaysTeens.org.
Joining me again this morning, Dr. Adam Carrington from Hillsdale College. Adam, welcome back.
Glad to be back. Hope everyone out there is safe.
We are safe. You know, I live far enough out into the country that I will just acknowledge to you, I spent most of my day yesterday bush hogging. So, which for people, you know, who live in cities, they don't even know what that is. So there you go. I feel like if everybody had a tractor and the opportunity to get out and till some soil and drive around in the fresh air, life would be better.
I could see cows from my bedroom window growing up, so yeah. I can at least somewhat relate.
It's happy. Okay, so Let's talk about some definite unhappiness. There's a reason that these third degree murder charges against former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. There's a reason. There's a lot of people unsatisfied with this. Part of that is people don't know what a third degree murder charge is because there's only three states in the entire nation that even have such a statute. Talk with us about this.
For those at least, and I originally got educated on these kinds of things watching like Law and Order and such. And what you have is usually first and second degree murder. First degree is premeditated. You planned it out. Second degree murder is you intended to kill, but it was a crime of the immediate passion. Third degree murder, where it does exist, is a kind of like heightened manslaughter. And the difference between second and third degree murder is really intent. That first and second degree murder, when you committed the action you did, you were trying, and in your mind, you were wanting to kill that person. And third degree murder is, like I said, kind of heightened manslaughter, where you acted recklessly with a callous disregard, I think the Minnesota statute says, for human life. But you maybe were not trying to, or at least they can't prove you were trying to actually terminate the person's life with what was being done. So it's very interesting. This is a window, I think, into what prosecutors, at least for now, think they can prove about the now fired police officer's intent in the death that's caused all this outrage and rioting.
And then I think what we're looking at in relationship to the other three officers, we heard the police chief yesterday actually use the term complicit. I feel like that means I was there, I was present, and I did nothing to help.
Yes, and that can be chargeable as well, depending upon the state laws of Minnesota, how far one can go. It might depend, but I think the idea is if someone is there committing a third degree murder, then there is some responsibility among those nearby, to take some action, and if these people were complicit, and there's definitely evidence on the video, some of the taunting that was going on of Mr. Floyd, that that I think not only was it they didn't do anything, but that they were actively sort of rooting this on. And so I think if you can prove the charges against the one officer, I think that there's definitely open to lesser charges against the other that didn't actually do it but seemed complicit in it.
All right, and then I have one more question on this, Adam. Thank you for tilling the soil with me. This officer had something like 18 complaints over the course of time. This is not a person who, you know, has just this unblemished record in terms of his behavior toward the people whom he had taken an oath to protect and serve. This is a sort of a more broad question about the police policing their own.
Yeah, and aren't we seeing this as a broader question, to try to cross some lines, some partisan lines that have developed over a lot of these things? I mean, isn't this similar, although this is much more visceral because person died, to the accusations that are being made against the FBI and other parts of the government, that they are not following procedures, they're not following the laws as they're written, and therefore they're not protecting people. And in that we the FBI instances, we go from questions of people's privacy or other things to hear the very life of a human being. What you're seeing is we create a government to exercise power because we can't trust ourselves to be vigilante justicers. And I think that makes it all the more painful, angering, and visceral when the people we've entrusted with this power, because we think it'll be better served, aren't doing it. And not to mention the racial element of this, where many in the African American community, you know, I'm white, so I can't say that I can in any way understand what's going on in the community, but trying to listen, seeing the frustration and anger that this is not a solitary incident, and therefore can't be seen as a merely solitary incident. I think that has to be brought into play as well.
Before you and I move on to other topics, I just think that in a reminder, I keep hearing people say, this is not who we are. These are not our values. And I want to say to them, this actually is who we are. Like, this has now happened enough times in enough places. There's enough evidence of this. There's enough witness against ourselves. At some point, we've got to get to the place where we acknowledge this is who we are in order that we can become different than we are. So talk with us about who we are.
Right. And I think because a lot of people, I think, are worried. You're always worried about what you might be admitting. And I think some people think they would be admitting that America is somehow the worst place in the world, that it is inherently more deeply unjust than any other government or polity in the history of the world. I would say that, well, you don't have to say that. In fact, you shouldn't have to say that to say that this is where we are, because I think a lot of American history, especially regarding race, with slavery, the civil rights movement, the best ways of reforming has been to say that we have established a certain principle of justice, a certain principle of that all men are created equal, that so much of our sinfulness fights against, but that we have committed ourselves to, and that we are not who we should be by our own standards. But that means that we can strive to be who we should be by our own standards. And I think that that can, on one hand, not try to sugarcoat and act as if nothing's wrong, but on the other hand, say we have it within ourselves to call ourselves to be better and to demand more of ourselves than we have up to this point.
Yeah, I completely resonate with that. We have to figure out how to move in the direction of bringing our actual lived practice into alignment with our espoused virtues. Like, we say these things about ourselves, but our actions betray us.
And I would even add something, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. has been brought up a lot. His famous I Have a Dream speech says we need to live out the true meaning of our creed, which was that all men are created equal, which means he's acknowledging, I think, something better, saying it better than I was, that principle that we have a creed, we have a commitment, but we need to live it out. And it is actually in some ways a testament to the deep fallibility of human beings that for centuries we've been able to see and to, I think, in some important ways, strive for the principle of the equal dignity of human beings, yet can fall so systematically short, even you know, this long into an attempt to live it out.
Yeah, and I think that for Christians, this is easy to understand because we can have great orthodoxy, we can have great espoused theology, and the living it out can bear witness against us. We can say wonderful things, we can give the Lord wonderful lip service, but if we're not then in turn actually living in alignment with Him, as Him and for Him, then it's lip service. We're saying things, but we're not. Yeah.
If I could say just one quick thing. Yesterday being Pentecost Sunday, Pentecost is the reversal of the Tower of Babel, and the Tower of Babel is where we were divided, not just by language, but I think it develops into all sorts of other differences. Pentecost, what was celebrated by the church yesterday, is a small glimpse of the undoing of Babel. And therefore, a small glimpse of a move toward every tribe, tongue, and nation in unity and love, worshiping together before the throne of God in Revelation. And I think that is a picture that we can hope for, even as we feel so far from it right now.
Amen. Amen. All right, Adam Carrington and I are going to take a very brief break. When we come back, we're going to change gears and talk about a few other things, including the Supreme Court. Unusual ruling late in the evening, rejecting church objections to the lockdown rules in both Illinois and California. That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen.
You're my defender. You fight for me. I will remember.
Continue my conversation with Dr. Adam Carrington. He tweets at Carrington AM. Adam, let's talk about the ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court in relationship to restrictions on crowds at church services.
Right. And this was a kind of emergency appeal. There were two of them from Illinois and California. And really what it was asking was, without the normal process of going through arguments and briefing and everything a court normally does, can there be a kind of emergency shutdown of Illinois and California's limits on church worship services? And this is an extraordinary thing. It doesn't happen ordinarily, as I was saying, but Illinois, on both counts, the court basically refused to go with the church's objections. In Illinois, they basically said Illinois changed their rules after the lawsuit started. So they said it's a different lawsuit now. You'll have to come back. But the California is the one people are talking about, because by a 5-4 vote, the court basically upheld for now the fact that churches have a 25% of their normal room capacity limit on who can worship in a worship service. And the argument was that this same limit of 25% is not being extended to grocery stores, to restaurants, to a number of other entities, that the argument is means that religious churches are not being treated the same. And so the argument really between the two sides was the four dissenting justices say this is discriminatory against religion. You're treating churches, in this case a Pentecostal church in California, differently than other like secular groups. And the majority, and really the deciding vote, was Justice Roberts. The Chief Justice was arguing that at least at this early period, based on what the court can see, it's not clear that you're comparing apples to apples with restaurants and churches. That I think the argument was some of these things like grocery stores, people go in and out quickly. Churches, you're in a confined space together for an hour or 2 hours. So that's really what it comes down to, is our churches being treated the same as other like organizations? And to do so, you've got to ask, what is the similarity between sitting, singing, and talking in a church and doing things like going to a grocery store? That's what it ultimately comes down to in relation to the pandemic.
I can see both arguments. I can see both sides. I will tell you that I would certainly expect to have more interaction with fellow Christians at church than I expect to have with fellow diners at a restaurant, because I don't know those people, or certainly fellow shoppers at a grocery store. So I do think the anticipation that this is a group of people that's going to be together and in their togetherness is likely to interact at a fairly in close proximity. Like, I get that argument. I do get I get both arguments here.
Yeah, I think it's a tough one. I wouldn't read into this, at least yet, religious animosity.
Mm-hmm.
I think it really is an attempt to say, is singing is what you do in church more likely to spread the virus, and therefore more legitimate to be regulated than other sorts than the other listed items. But I think the dissent, and the dissent was Justices Kavanaugh, Justice Gorsuch, Justice Thomas, and Justice Alito. They I think said, we've got to police this really closely, though. You can't let this slide, and they think that it has in this instance. So extreme circumstances really test how we apply our principles, even if we're still affirming the right principles, because the actual instance of application gets really thorny. So, I think this is something that this is not the last we've heard of this. And if states continue to do this, I think a Justice Roberts might be willing to decide differently if you tweak the situation, tweak the rules, tweak the circumstances slightly. I don't think this is saying any attempt to shut down churches, any attempt to regulate them is just allowed, and there's no constitutional protections.
And if the Miami Dolphins can convert their big stadium into a drive-in movie theater and put 230 cars in there pretty close together, we ought to be able to have drive-in church. Like, there are some things here that you're just like, okay. Hey, one more thing before we let you go. Give us a little sense of your take on the president's social media executive order.
Yeah, this can get into legal minutia really quickly, so I'll try not to do that. The bigger issue is the president is frustrated that what he sees to be lack of accountability by what big tech platforms that host other people speaking, like Twitter accounts, Facebook, things like that. He's also frustrated that platforms like that have edited him and other people that agree with him, and he sees that as shutting down free and open discourse. So there's this executive order that is is seeking to get a new bureaucratic rule, a new agency regulation related to, you'll hear a lot of what's called Section 230. It's basically how since 1996 we have regulated the liability of of platforms that host internet content. So things like Twitter and Facebook. And so what they're wanting to do is basically make it a lot easier for people to sue Facebook and Twitter, and for the government to punish Facebook and Twitter if they're perceived to not being fair to the people that they're hosting. I would just say I've got two issues with I don't think that their problems are entirely unfounded. I do think that the way this is going about has two issues. One, I don't think it really reads the law correctly. I think if you want to be more aggressive against these companies, you're going to have to change the law itself. Two, I worry about some of the enforcement mechanisms of this. The president and a lot of his followers have run against what they call the administrative or the deep state, these sort of bureaucrats that operate without much control. I think this unintentionally asks a lot of the federal bureaucrats to be policing a lot of online content, not just with Facebook and Twitter, but others, in a way that I think could really backfire and not accomplish the kind of things that they're wanting, but actually involve more censorship when they're trying to undo and do less. So I see the underlying issue, but I think in the end, it's fairly dangerous for free speech in the future. It's the problem of unintended consequences.
Adam Carrington, thank you as always so much. That's particularly helpful. And I think that we haven't heard the end of that, right? I think that's fair to say.
Nope. This will go on for a while.
Yeah. Hey, thanks so much, brother. We'll talk with you again.
Always a pleasure. Hope everyone
Likewise.
Stays safe still.
Yep. Amen. Stay safe. Stay safe. Okay, so as you begin to approach this day, one of the things that I want you to be aware of are the good news headlines of the day. I don't want us to miss out on the positive things that are happening in our communities across the country and around the world. Let's pray today for the astronauts now aboard, the NASA astronauts who, hitched a ride on SpaceX's Dragon capsule. Let's be praying for them. Like, outer space is an interesting place to be. I hope they send us really cool pictures of planet Earth so we can be reminded of just how small and blue and beautiful it is. Let's be praying today for those business owners across the country whose livelihoods were already at risk and now whose shop fronts have been shattered. And if you've got time and can do it, get out there today and help clean up your own community. Let's get out there shoulder to shoulder, brooms in hand, trash bags. Let's clean up America today. Let's do our part. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.